This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Jeff Cooper, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with RFA's Jeff Cooper next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net. Providing individualized protection on more than 540 million acres of farmland, crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The renewable fuels industry produces nearly 16 billion gallons of ethanol annually and is operating at just over 85% of its capacity. Jeff Cooper, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association, says ethanol-blended gasoline and sustainable aviation fuel can help satisfy consumers who are willing to pay more to protect the environment.
Consumers aren't just interested in knowing more about how their food is produced and where their food comes from. It's the same with fuel. They are increasingly interested in the attributes or the characteristics of the fuels that they are putting in their vehicles. That's why you see all this interest in electric vehicles today is the notion is that an electric vehicle is going to be better for the environment, better for the climate. But when it comes to ethanol, we have an incredibly positive story to tell in terms of the environmental benefits, and we are doing more and more to make sure that story is being told to the consumer. When it comes to tailpipe emissions, when you're using ethanol blends, whether it's E10, whether it's E15, and certainly if it's a flex fuel like E85, you're seeing significant reductions in the emissions of those pollutants that lead to poor air quality and lead to human health problems. We're talking about particulate matter, right? That those really fine particles that come out the tailpipe when fuels are combusted. That PM pollution, that particulate matter, goes way down when we're using ethanol blends. We see reductions in carbon monoxide emissions. We see reductions in nitrogen oxides, NOx, which is a dangerous pollutant. So that's what's happening at the tailpipe. But then when you look at the overall carbon impacts, the greenhouse gas impacts of using ethanol, we see substantial reductions when we're substituting ethanol for gasoline as well. Even at a low level, when we're talking about 10% ethanol blends or 15% ethanol blends, you are getting significant reductions in all of those emissions that contribute to poor air quality and lead to, you know, increased greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere. So that's the environmental benefit of using ethanol. It's a message that we continue to, convey not only to consumers, but to policymakers as well, who are looking at future policies to reduce emissions from our transportation sector. We're saying, look, ethanol has been doing that for 40 years and can continue to do that. Give us or allow us an opportunity to expand the use of ethanol in our nation's fuel supply, and we will absolutely see greater emissions reductions.
I recall the picture by Norman Rockwell of the store merchant with his finger on top of the scale and the consumer on the other side with her finger on the bottom of the scale. The scale is very important as we evaluate for the environment. The scale is also important from a tax perspective, from a taxpayer dollar perspective of which industry is supported. So what was so critical to the ethanol industry and renewable fuels that the GREET model be used in evaluating?
So that's a perfect analogy, and I know exactly the Norman Rockwell painting you're talking about, and all we're asking for, all we're asking our federal government to do is take its finger off the scale and let decisions around what forms of energy will be used and demanded by the consumer, let those be driven by the marketplace and let fairness and scientific integrity really be what drives these decisions and these policies. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that when it comes to energy policy in this country. But as far as it relates to sustainable aviation fuels, you're right. What leads to a level playing field for ethanol when it comes to sustainable aviation fuels is making sure we are using a scientifically sound methodology for calculating or estimating the carbon impacts of making aviation fuels from corn ethanol and other biofuels. It's critically important that the best methodology, the most scientifically sound methodology, is being used for those calculations, and that is the GREET model. That's the Department of Energy's GREET model. It uses the most current data. It has the best understanding, best reflection of what is actually happening in the industry today built into that model. And the reason all this is important is determinations of eligibility for that tax credit come down to the carbon intensity of the fuel, and to measure carbon intensity, you have to have a model. So it really is the issue that will make or break the sustainable aviation fuel opportunity for corn producers and ethanol producers. If we end up getting stuck with a bad model and a misrepresentation of the carbon footprint of corn ethanol, that market is going to be closed to us. On the other hand, if we do end up with a version of the GREET model that properly characterizes what's happening in our industries today, it could open the door to a enormous opportunity for agriculture and renewable fuels moving forward.
So the decision was made that the GREET model would be used, but that the GREET model would be modified with an announcement coming by the 1st of March. The devil's always in the details. What are you watching there?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a situation where we got some good news, but the job isn't done yet. We did see that guidance published by the Department of Treasury on December 15th, and it did say, yes, the GREET model will be an allowable methodology for determining eligibility for these tax credits, but further revisions and modifications need to be made to the model before we allow its use by the taxpayers who would be applying for these credits. That work is supposed to be done by March 1st. USDA is involved, EPA is involved, the Department of Energy is involved, so it really is a cross-government kind of multi-agency effort. But we are anxiously awaiting the resolution of that process, and we're anxiously wanting to take a look at what this model is going to look like.
Jeff, last week, Secretary Vilsack announcing $19 million in grants, and that would be used in projects in 22 different states to help infrastructure of consumers being able to access the product. The question here is about infrastructure. Are there enough pumps in place where any consumer in the country that wants to buy flexible fuel or renewable fuel has access to it?
Well, we're making progress, but it's a slower transition than we'd like to see. And just for context, there are roughly 125 or 130,000 retail stations that sell fuel today across the United States. Of that amount, about 5,500 or close to 6,000 stations are offering flex fuels like E85, and roughly 3,500 stations are selling E15. So you can see we've got a long way to go if we are going to increase and improve consumer access to these lower cost fuels. And that's where the grant funding from USDA becomes very important. It allows retailers who want to transition to E15 or E85, it allows them to really help defray their costs of making these infrastructure upgrades. These are small businesses in many cases. They don't often have the resources to just go out and put new dispensers in or a new tank underground if that's necessary. And so having these grant funds available from USDA really helps in that endeavor. And this is really kind of the latest in a long-running program from USDA called the HBIP program. That's an acronym. It's been very successful over the years in helping retailers put this infrastructure in at low cost or no cost to them, and helping us get broader access and availability for the consumer when it comes to E15 and higher blends.
Has Washington been fair with its checkbook from renewable fuels to the push into the electric vehicle market?
Well, I would say this. There are far more resources pointing toward electrification today than there are toward low-carbon biofuels. And the program we just talked about, that $19 million, that was part of a program that was included in the Inflation Reduction Act. There was $500 million in that bill that was allocated or set aside for biofuels infrastructure. And that's a lot of money, but it pales in comparison to the value of the incentives and grant programs and other assistance for electric vehicles that was provided in that bill, but also other legislation that's come out of Congress the last few years. There is a substantial investment that our government is making today in electrification, and they're really, in many cases, putting all their eggs into that basket, and that concerns us for a whole lot of reasons, and we don't think it's real smart. Again, it comes back to that scale and taking your finger off the scale. We certainly support the idea of investing in cleaner fuels, lower carbon fuels, but we don't think the government should be nearly as prescriptive as it has been in recent years, and it should say, look, here's grant funding that's available for any and all low carbon fuels as long as they're able to demonstrate and prove their environmental benefits. It's there for the taking, and we think that would be a better approach, something that's technology neutral, it's performance based, and it's not picking winners and losers and specifying technologies.
On the total cycle, on the total scale, what can we say is better for the environment?
Yeah, in fact, there's just been some analysis very recently completed that looks at that very question, that takes these different fuel options and different vehicle options and when compares them on a level playing field and asks the question, what are the life cycle carbon impacts or greenhouse gas impacts of these various fuel and vehicle options? And as you might expect, if an electric vehicle is being powered exclusively by coal-fired electricity, it's the worst option out there. It's worse than a internal combustion engine using E10, and in some cases worse than an internal combustion engine using ethanol-free gasoline. I think that really speaks to the importance, again, of making apples-to-apples comparisons. When we move up the scale and we're using blends like E15 or E30, or you get to E85, those vehicles and those fuels are head-to-head competitive with electric vehicles using the cleanest source of electricity, you know, whether that's solar or wind or hydro or others. If you are driving a flex fuel vehicle with E85 in the tank, it is providing, you know, a comparable level of carbon reduction to an electric vehicle that is driving on wind or solar. So those are the things that we need to get through to policymakers. You know, unfortunately, when we, again, going back to the analogy of the finger on the scale, you know, we have some EPA regulations and proposals that are out there right now that want to treat electric vehicles as zero emissions vehicles because they don't have a tailpipe, and so therefore the assumption is there's no emissions. Well, that's ridiculous. We know that there are upstream emissions associated with using that vehicle. And today in the U.S., we still get 20% of our electricity from coal. We still get 40% of our electricity from natural gas, 20% from nuclear. There's really only 14 or 15% of the electricity that's produced in this country today that comes from wind or solar. Yet EPA and many in Congress are just assuming that every EV out there on the road today is being powered with that low carbon or you know, cleaner source of electricity.
Jeff, in the opinion of the Renewable Fuels Association and your industry, is the EPA within its jurisdiction for the tailpipe emission standards that it has offered? And what would the impact of those standards be if they were put in place today?
That's an issue we are watching very closely. EPA last spring, I think it was April of 2023, proposed new tailpipe emission standards for vehicles built between 2027 and 2032. And essentially, the stringency of those standards that they are proposing means that no automaker could meet those standards without dramatically increasing their production of electric vehicles. And again, the reason for that is those regulations treat electric vehicles as zero emissions. So they're getting, basically a very strong incentive, a subsidy, you might say, through this regulation to build electric vehicles at the expense of other vehicles that can, as we've discussed, reduce emissions to the same extent or same degree or more so. So we are very concerned with the direction that proposed rule from EPA is going. We've shared those concerns with the agency. Many others have as well. We are expecting a final regulation from EPA sometime this spring. And there have been a number of legal concerns when you ask about jurisdiction and authority to do some of these things. There have been a number of concerns raised by stakeholders about whether EPA has exceeded its authority with this regulation, with this proposal, which, they're basically using as a de facto electric vehicle mandate. So it's something we're going to be paying very close attention to. We are eager to see whether EPA makes some changes to its final rule to level the playing field and take its finger off the scale and allow other clean fuels, other low carbon options to help automakers meet these standards long term.
Jeff, following with the theme of the concern over the environment, now you have the airline industry very interested in sustainable fuel, even though it is not the lowest cost. What's the impact, or what is the impetus for growth of sustainable airline fuel, and what could it mean for the Midwest if all the airlines or a majority were to make this move?
It could be a transformational opportunity for agriculture and biofuels if we were to fully transition to sustainable aviation fuels. And just to give you an idea of how large that marketplace is, last year, the U.S. aviation sector used about 25 billion gallons of aviation fuel. And today that is, essentially all petroleum-based, kerosene-based jet fuel. So if we were able to tap into that marketplace with renewable fuels like corn ethanol, you can see just how enormous that marketplace could be. It's projected to continue growing. The Department of Energy says by 2030 or 2035, we could be looking at 35 billion gallons of demand for aviation fuel. So it is a substantial opportunity for growth in the industry. It could be as consequential for growth in our sector as the renewable fuel standard was. I think everybody remembers sort of the hockey stick growth we saw in ethanol production and the building of new biorefineries following passage of the RFS and its expansion again in 2007. We could see that same sort of growth under a sustainable aviation fuel program if it's done correctly.
How important is the pipeline issue to the future of renewable fuels and sustainable aviation fuel?
Well, it's very important because today, if you make sustainable aviation fuel out of corn ethanol, because it requires additional energy and processing, you end up with a source of aviation fuel that is about 20 to 25% less carbon intensive than petroleum-based jet fuel. In order to qualify for that tax credit, you got to be 50% less carbon intensive than petroleum-based jet fuel. So the quickest way for our industry to get from a 25% reduction today on jet fuel to a 50% or greater reduction is through the adoption of carbon capture and sequestration. And that's where these pipelines come into play because, unfortunately, there are a lot of ethanol plants out there today that are in locations where they don't have the suitable geology adjacent to their facility to just, to go straight down with that CO2 and store it on site. It needs to be transmitted via pipeline to parts of the Midwest that have more suitable geology for that permanent storage. So it is a very important issue. Those pipelines are going to be critical to ethanol continuing to shrink its carbon footprint, lower its carbon intensity score, and that's really the key here that unlocks the door to some of these larger opportunities like sustainable aviation fuel.
And then there's California. and I noted a story on your website suggesting that California was slow walking renewable fuels.
They are, and it's unfortunate. I mean, California today remains the largest marketplace for ethanol in the U.S., more ethanol consumed in that state than any other state in the country, but they are the only state out of all 50 that today does not allow the sale of E15. There were two states. Montana was the other one, but on January 1st of this year, they finally updated their regulations, and so we can sell E15 in Montana today, and that leaves California as the lone holdout when it comes to the sale of E15, and there's no good reason for it. We've done all the emissions testing that they've required and asked us to do. It has all shown significant benefits, as we've talked about, but now we're being told by the California government that, well, you know, we have other priorities when it comes to fuels. We've got changes to our low-carbon fuel standard that we're making. We've got Governor Newsom's electric vehicle mandate that we got to figure out how to you know, implement that. So we might get around to approving E15 sometime, but it's not going to be anytime soon. That is incredibly frustrating for us because of all the work and investment we've put into opening that market to E15. But it's also frustrating for consumers in that state who are being denied access to a lower cost fuel and a lower carbon fuel. Again, E15 could help the state of California meet its very aggressive goals and objectives for reducing carbon emissions, and they're leaving those reductions and those opportunities on the table by not approving E15, which would be a very simple stroke of the pen for them.
Jeff, can the petroleum industry and the renewable fuels industry ever get along?
Yes, I think we can get along, and in fact, it's happening. I think we've had more collaboration and cooperation with many of the folks in the petroleum industry in the last few years than we've ever had before. Of course, there are still policy issues that we disagree on, but I would say in the last few years we have seen just an evolution in the relationship between our industries, and I think they in the petroleum industry are recognizing that they need biofuels because of some of the state and national and frankly international policy developments that we've seen around climate policy and carbon reduction. And so we are seeing I'd say a better relationship. Some of those old wounds are being healed. Some of those old battle lines are being erased, but we still have work to do to proceed with a lower carbon future and a lower cost options for consumers moving forward.
Jeff Cooper, we want to thank you for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. Certainly no shortage of issues to talk about here into the new year. Fuel is just one of the issues that Congress is set to address, and it's always a topic on Capitol Hill. But Jeff, this is Open Mic and your opportunity to have the last word in the interview today.
Well, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me. And I think as a last word, I would just want to highlight again that, you know, when we look at the direction that policy is headed, whether it's energy policy, climate policy, it's all focused on decarbonization, lowering carbon emissions from transportation fuels, but other products as well. And our message has been consistently, look, we have a product in ethanol that is available today. We're producing 16 billion gallons of the stuff. We could be producing 18 billion gallons of the stuff on an annual basis. It's already reducing emissions. It's already offered at a lower cost than competing alternatives. Let's make better use of this strategic national asset that we have in our renewable fuels industry. We can absolutely help meet and address carbon reduction goals, economic goals, energy security goals in a way that's going to be more affordable for the consumer in the long term. And again, not to keep going back to the same analogy, but all we're asking for is a level playing field. We're asking for that finger to be taken off the scale and just a fair environment where we can compete on our merits. And we think doing so is going to help consumers save money and access cleaner fuels from coast to coast.
Our thanks to Jeff Cooper, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.